Okay, well, I think I'll get started while you're passing out the paper and pencils. Just make sure you have at least one blank side to that paper. It's just for you to scratch a little drawing on in a few minutes. I am Gretchen Begelman. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana. I teach in the Honors College, Christ College at Valparaiso University. And I teach a wide variety of things in the humanities, but my background is in American history and culture with an emphasis on art and architecture. And this week I'm going to be talking about American places, three sessions on, yes, five sessions this week, three on American houses and building patterns of domestic spaces, and two at the end of the week on churches. And although I might call myself an architectural historian, I'm not your typical architectural historian who would be interested in the great architects and stylistic chains of influence and that sort of thing. I'm much more interested in ordinary buildings and what those buildings say about the people that make them and use them and change them over time, what kind of values they reveal, how you read a space for cultural historical information, and how we should then learn from that in ways to think about our own spaces. And this is not a picture of houses, as you may have noticed. These are churches. But in case I don't get to see any of you, some of you in the rest of my sessions this week, I just wanted to enlist your help in my current research project, which is on the expansion of the denominations into the suburbs after World War II, and particularly the building of modern style churches. So if any of you have memories of this, of being involved in building projects, of growing up in Sunday schools in these 1950s and 60s buildings, I would love to talk to you. I would love to get your memories, so please come and bend my ear with your stories. I would appreciate that very much. And I will be talking about churches on Thursday and Friday. But for today, the topic is houses. Here's one extreme. This is Hearst Castle in San Simeon, California, on the lovely California coast. This is the largest historic house museum in America, 90,000 square feet, I believe, including these Roman-like swimming pools and so forth. Not typical, but perhaps a dream for certain Americans, and one of the reasons that it is one of the most visited historic sites in the United States is that people love to walk through these spaces and see the private lives of people like, in this case, Randolph Hearst and his cronies. But on the other extreme, there are places like this, a Masadi from the late 19th century in North Dakota. And some of you perhaps have family stories about relatives living in sod houses. So these are all American homes. They're important repositories of values and memories and family history. So what can we say about these things? Well, tonight I'm going to focus on just fairly ordinary, middle-class, working-class American housing. And I'd like to pause right here. I hope all of you have a piece of paper and a pencil. And just to... If you were at Fred Meador's Bible study this morning, he said, he quoted his wife's grandfather's tombstone in Chesterton, Indiana, that said, everyone has to be someplace. And I like that because it's true. We live in places. We talk about communities, but these communities shape and are shaped by this built environment that we create. One of the reasons we come to Holden, besides the community, is the built environment here, the natural environment here. We're drawn to certain places. We're perhaps repulsed by other places. So just to get us to start thinking spatially, what I'd like you to do is take that piece of paper and pencil and sketch out the floor plan of some place that you've lived that's been meaningful to you. Preferably some place you enjoyed living, but it doesn't have to be that. So try to think in terms of perhaps an apartment you lived in at one time. Doesn't have to be a whole house. But think about spaces and try to take your pencil and sketch the contours of rooms. And I'm not going to take a look at these. This is really for your own experiment here. But try to do that. Just take a few minutes trying to sketch out an outline of a space that you have inhabited, someplace that has been home to you.
a deep breath and shout a little louder.
Shout a little louder. Can you hear me over here? Okay.
You're really soft.
Okay. Don't have a loudly protecting voice. Well, just keep raising your hand if you can't hear me.
This was built in 685, and if you go to the website, it's got the history of the architecture.
I'm not sure why some places stay with us more than others. I think we moved about 5 years ago in the house that we lived in for the 10 years before that, where our children were born and so forth. I still dream of those spaces. I still can remember the scratches in the walls and where the baseboards were torn up, and I can put myself back in that space very clearly. So I think even the places we don't inhabit anymore have a way of staying with us and shaping our memories. Now, with those sketches, find a place in that space where you felt especially secure and mark that space. And then after that, think of a place that you think of as being happy. Maybe the same place you felt secure. Mark that space. Can you hear me in the back now? Okay?
Not well.
No. Yeah, maybe there's some seats over here that might work better. I'm just not projecting well. Okay, now I'm just going to ask you, what those happy and safe places, where do they tend to be in the homes?
Kitchens?
Dining rooms?
Family room?
Kitchen with a view of the garden.
That's an interesting point, because especially when we're talking about single family homes in rural or more suburban areas, it's not just a house, it's a relationship between the house and a certain piece of land. Okay, now I want you to just hang on to that, because I'm gonna run through some history of American housing over time, and then we're gonna end up in some modern housing developments, and we'll be looking at some floor plans and talking about how those houses develop. One thing I'd like to say, first of all, is about the meaning of home. And in America, this is not that this isn't true in other countries and other cultures, but there's a particular religious moral charge to what home is, and that gets associated with the house as well. So it's a place of here in the, this is a depiction of the 17th century where the father is leading home. In the 19th century, it becomes gendered a little bit differently, where the woman is the angel of the house, and in that domestic environment, she provides a Christian moral environment that's an antidote to the harsh business world on the outside. And this is something that when you say the word home, there's a resonance, there's a moral resonance for many people still, I believe. One of the ways we do this as Americans, in terms of the built environment and what we're actually looking at, has to do with heroes of our culture, people that whose legacy we value, that we think of as critical to American identity, foundational values, and so forth. So here's Mount Vernon Plantation, which was a home that George Washington inherited from his brother and was built initially on this piece of property in the mid-18th century, then expanded several times by George Washington in the 1770s. This particular look of a house, which we'll call in its many appearances in the afterlife, is a colonial revival. So here's a fraternity house in Valparaiso. That's basically Mount Vernon. So one of the things to know when you're looking at style of architecture is how particular styles keep coming back. And that's because of the moral content of those styles and what that evokes. For instance, in post-war suburbs, where the churches were often modern, the schools were modern, the civic buildings, the shopping malls were all largely modern, houses still often had this colonial look. Even though inside they were modern, on the outside they would be some version of clapboard shutters. Shutters do nothing on most houses. They're pieces of metal that are stuck to the side. You know, why do we do that? Well, this is why, because it evokes Mount Vernon and so forth. And then I was at a conference in Montana last week, in Butte, Montana, studying the vernacular architecture of that place, another copper mining town. And was struck by these buildings in particular. These are in this rougher area of town where many of the miners lived. Literally thousands of miners inhabited this space where they built homes out of found discarded materials. And then by the 1950s were living in trailers there. These are dirt floor homes, and it wasn't just the miners. It was often miners and their wives and their children. And these are uninsulated buildings in a very cold area in Montana, but inside these buildings, this is a restoration of that based on historical documentation, but these were places people were trying to make home. They were trying to create, especially the one on the upper left, this one is a miner's, you can see the still in the corner, so something else is going on here, but up in the upper left, this is a home. It's somebody's home that's been. The average life of a miner in this place and time was late 20s. So these are young families that are struggling, yet there's the hearth, the stove, and amenities that are struggling to create this idea of hearth and home, even in very difficult circumstances. Okay, any questions so far? Yes?
Well, it's interesting. Could you go back
sure.
to that last slide? That upper one, I would guess 400, 500 square feet?
Yeah.
Which is enough for basics. And we've grown our housing to a norm of 2,500 or 3,000 square feet. And that's really expensive. It really takes up a large percentage of the income of the people that live there.
Excellent point, and I'll be returning to that at the end. I think that's one of the critical changes in housing since the mid-20th century to the present. It's reversing a little bit right now, so we'll get back to that. Good point. So here we are at about the same time as Mount Vernon, and this is a home that was inhabited by a fairly well-to-do farm family on the Connecticut River Valley of western Massachusetts. As New England land goes, this was fairly fertile land, and the farmers did quite well. And this is the floor plan from the 1750s. And what I'd like you to think about here are a few things that characterized the housing of that time. In the Northeast, especially, that there would have been a large central chimney. And that we think of the hearth as being the center of the home. And in this case, that's structural as well as kind of emotional, because the major framing members of the home went right into this massive chimney stack. So it was literally holding up a lot of the house. And so on the right, you have a kitchen space on the upper right, and that little round area is the bake oven with a large cooking area. Sometimes these houses would have had a lean-to in the back with an external kitchen. Large entry hall Often farm business would have been done in a space like this, so business is going on in this home. A sitting room and a parlor to the left and a more private sitting room on the right. These are private slash public spaces. And a dining room to the back, a little more private, and then bedrooms would have been upstairs. But very simple plan. And this is it. When you look at the more complex plans later, you'll see the addition of many things, like, for instance, closets that didn't exist in these early house plans. And another thing is multiple use of these spaces was very common. So as you see in these two rooms on the bottom, this is the parlor that's on the lower left there. Although the, can somebody pull that? I guess you're seeing. Let me know if you can't see on the either side and we can adjust that. Oh, there you go. Great, thanks. The corner cupboard isn't in the plan, but this is some kind of storage on the right here, this corner cupboard. But what you typically see in these houses is furniture placed to the edges of a room and then moved out for various uses. We don't tend to do that now, unless you have a big family gathering. You leave the furniture where it is. You're not moving the sofa around day to day. But that was very common in these earlier homes. Now, jumping ahead, this is the mid-19th century. Andrew Jackson Downing was a very important American architect of domestic spaces. He had a background in landscape architecture as well. Worked in near Newport, New York, which is along the Hudson River. And some of you may be familiar with the Hudson River Valley School of American Painting, people like Church, Frederick Church. And so there's a great emphasis on aesthetics, on landscape, on the romantic views that we're trying to construct with the built environment and with our art. And this is a time of a revival of a lot of older styles. Here you see this 19th century spin on the Gothic. What is it that makes this Gothic? It's not a big, cold castle, but what makes it Gothic is certain kinds of arches. This particular house plan is very common, too. I'm sure you've seen these things, especially if you traveled in the northern part of the United States, really across the U.S. with that central gable. I'm sure you've all seen houses like this from the 19th century. So little features like that, it's Gothic-y, or the chimney stacks, which look like an old English style. So not historically correct. This is not for the reproduction of an English castle. This is to evoke those romantic associations with a certain kind of English country life. And in this plan, this is just the first floor of this building, just want to point out a few things. Room use changes over time. And in this period, if you get to the middle class or slightly above that, there's often a space that's designated as a library, and certainly a parlor. Parlor was a fundamental, maybe some of you grew up in homes where there was a parlor that no one ever used, kind of like the living room now that's got glass doors and you go in there for Christmas and kind of sits there. The parlor was used more than that in this period, but it was still the most formal room in the house. And you see the bay window sitting area there, and then it crosses into the library. One thing to note, it didn't have the dimensions in that earlier house, but these are much larger rooms than there were in that Connecticut River Valley farmhouse. You start to see closets up there in the upper left, and the kitchen on the back of the house. Now, some things that are invisible in this plan that you could see if you had more complex plans from this time are service areas. Because often these families, even middle-class families, would have had a staff of house workers, often immigrants from places like Ireland later in the 19th century. And they were to do their work but not be seen by many other people and formal guests to the house. So there would be back passages and rooms on the third floor and places these people could be supervised by the house, by those who ran the household, but not obtrusive in what they did. And that's written into the house plans. So at this point, houses are getting bigger, and it doesn't cost a lot to expand a house. You don't have a lot of systems. You don't have electricity, indoor plumbing, and appliances. So it's just a matter of, and once you get the balloon frame of construction, adding another room, making the dimensions larger, really doesn't add tremendously to the cost of the house.
Where do they eat? Yeah. Was it in the kitchen? There's no separate dining room.
In kitchen, actually, I think in this case, there was that back bedroom that's labeled a bedroom. would have also been like a family dining room.
And why a pantry off a library?
Okay, I should say also, this is not a house plan that a builder would have taken and developed a house directly, absolutely from that. This is a kind of dream book. So here's Andrew Jackson Downing's Designs for Country Houses. Read through this and dream about what your perfect house might be. So there are inconsistencies like that that you've noticed. Thank you.
And an umbrage, what is that? There is an umbrage.
A porch. And it's what you see here. And it's related to, there's an Italian villa style that's popular at the same time, which is this this house in Indiana like that. And you may have noticed there's been a revival of interest in Victorian houses, and many new developments have these. They don't dominate, but I've certainly seen developments where they're popular. They tend to be fussier, have large porches and interesting roof lines. That's a result of postmodernism and the just freely borrowing from all sorts of historic styles and combining them in interesting and sometimes successful, sometimes unsuccessful ways. But that's a modern development there, that picture on the right. And these are images of the parlor in these houses. And just as the exteriors get more complex, more historic resonances and references, the interiors, when you think of Victorian interiors, what do you think of?
Dark, fussy.
Dark, fussy. Lots of conflicting patterns, lots of layers of textiles. There's a boom in the availability of consumer goods at this time and a rising discretionary income for the middle class. So lots more stuff than you would have seen in earlier houses. They're still not approaching what we have in modern houses, but nonetheless, much more than before. Okay, now I'm skipping through a lot, but I wanted to get to the 1920s bungalow because this is a style of housing that was very important in the expansion, especially in the Midwest. And those of you from Seattle or Portland, areas like that, are very familiar with 1920s, 1930s bungalows. I'm sure there are wonderful buildings out there. And this was a housing type that brought housing within the reach of the working class in ways that really wasn't so possible before. And what you're looking at here is the Revere, so ignore the plan of the Reynolds up there. Little bungalow, this is the whole thing. You walk in on the porch, the plan is turned a little bit there. You walk in on the porch, straight into a dining room that opens into a kitchen. There's one bathroom off there and a living room to the front. Many of these houses have very open plans. This is a source for the way that some designers think about housing today. And the emphasis is on coziness, which is often a way to say, well, we really don't have the money to buy a big house, so we're going to have a cozy cottage, and we'll put a big emphasis on how wonderful that is, and also efficiency. So the tagline with this is a charming little colonial cottage of four rooms, but with five-room efficiency. The space-saving bed swings out of its closet and into the living room when occasion requires. So I'm trying to cram a lot in a small space, but they're extremely nice buildings and very family-friendly. I mean, as I said, there are many of them out there on the landscape.
I have a question.
Yes.
The bungalows, were the bungalows the kind of housing that you could get from Sears catalog?
Some of them, yeah.
For
those of you who don't know, there were mail order houses available in the early 20th century. Sears Roebuck was one of the largest providers of it. Just arrive on the railroad and all the nails, everything, and you had to find a local builder or put it together yourself. And a wide range of styles, bungalows were among them. Also a lot of little colonial revival cottages or New England looking cottages, capes, two stories. There's some wonderful books written about Sears Roebuck houses if you're interested in trying to be able to identify those on the landscape. Thank you for that question. This is an interior of a slightly larger bungalow, but you get the sense it's kind of low and sheltering. There's often a wonderful alcove with fireplace, a nook. Nook was a common word in these plans. This coincides with the rise in interest in arts and crafts, so a lot of the furnishings that appear in at least the model homes are meant to look like they were crafted by hand, even in though in fact they were made in factories on the East Coast or in the Midwest, but this heavy, Sears sold this kind of furniture as well. What might, some can be called craftsman style furniture or mission style furniture is another term for that. But it's a very much a sense of a smaller, cozy space that's sheltering. And this also, here's an example of one of these in Valparaiso. And I wanted to show you this because any of you familiar with Disney's Celebration? This is a new urbanist community in Florida that people love to make fun of, but in fact it's a very successful community in a lot of ways. It's a planned development that's trying to create the small town feelings, and in many ways does that successfully, but a lot of the houses are like this. And this is the image, the cozy bungalow, the patriotism, and then with the contrasting white pillars in front and the clapboards on the side, which may be vinyl siding, but it looks like the old wood clapboards. This harks back to Mount Vernon as well. So you have multiple influences here that all evoke that core belief in American morality associated with the home and the strength of the individual within his own home and her own home. Questions? Okay, now I'm not going to say much about multiple unit housing, but I don't want to ignore that because many, many people in America live in buildings like this today, not just single family homes. This building here with this brown sign in front here, this is the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York City. If any of you get to New York City, you must go to this museum. It's just a fabulous reconstruction of the tenements that the first generation of immigrants lived in. This is a building that, because of changing codes in the 1930s, the landlord didn't want to deal with it and just shut off the top four floors of the building in 1935, and it wasn't discovered until the 1980s. So it's this wonderful repository of history, and curators have gone in and peeled back the layers of wallpaper and looked at original finishes, and just a terrific place. So a little plug for that museum. And there were certain companies who really thought very seriously about worker housing. This is in the Pullman development outside of Chicago where the railroad workers live. This is slightly upscale housing there. But Pullman was greatly influenced by, for instance, the development Sunnyside, which the Lever brothers built near Liverpool in England, which was a garden city or a garden suburb designed to create a healthy and moral community for their workers, from the lower paid workers all the way up to management, to create a kind of community. And actually it's similar to Holden and the sorts of things that happen in a company town like this. Okay, and here is multiple unit housing today. This is a Toll Brothers, one of the major builders in the United States today. This is a luxury, mixed use community in Las Vegas. And these are very expensive condos, but still people living in buildings, sharing the building with other families and other living units. But the reason I'm wanted to turn to this right now is that I think this illustrates very well where we've come in 100 years. Here on the left is a building similar to that tenement museum, and on the right, just for some sort of comparison, I guess students live in tenements often, so here's the modern student apartment. Here, this is worth pointing out. This is because of the original tenements were often without proper ventilation, without plumbing at all, and so forth. So some legislation led to required spaces between the buildings, so you get this plan that's called the dumbbell plan. And so here you see four apartments, tenements, very small, 11 by 12, 10 by 11, two bedrooms, and you get from one bedroom to the other. There's no light back here at all except from this shaft, so if you're on the first floor of a fourth row building, you're not getting much light down there. Two toilets to be shared by that group of families. Very few amenities and really crowded. And then on the right, this is where we are today. Would you like to help me point out some of the differences here? Things that you see that tell us where the culture of housing has gone.
This is comparable dimensions?
No, these are bigger rooms, and that's one thing to look at.
But I mean the total...
These are smaller, and these would have had many more people in them. than these larger spaces.
It's not for those.
No, oh, right, thank you, yeah. The dimensions, I don't know if you can read these, but here, this is 11 by 12, this space here, and this is 11 by 13, I think, so.
What's the total square footage in the?
On the?
Yeah.
On that one, well, I don't, I guess you could figure it out. 20, yeah, 22 by 30, 40.
600.
Eight, 600, 700 square feet, something like that. So, not a whole lot larger, a little more space. What are the really big differences you see in those spaces?
There's water in what, one, two, three places?
Indoor plumbing, sanitation has come a long way in the last 100 years, so we have a full bathroom with a sink, a toilet, a tub. That, next to that here is an area for laundry, because here laundry was going to the back of the tenement building and using up the public fountain and dragging up on the stairs your pot with water to the top to boil on the stove. So, okay, very good.
Usable windows.
Yes, lots of windows, better light.
Closets.
Much more space for storage, right? And in general, what do you think that suggests about culture when you start to see more storage space?
They have more to put in.
More stuff, more things to put in, right?
It is, you know, for graduate student housing, but the presence of an extra room just for study is where no one lives.
Yeah, good point.
You know, the one on the right is about what you see for a lot of apartments in sort of like in big cities for Vancouver, the modern buildings.
Similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kitchen also, a fully equipped open kitchen with proper ventilation. This would have been a coal-burning stove with terrible ventilation, running even in the summer because of the work that needed to be done. And the hidden things here are Georgia, probably air conditioning, certainly adequate heating. So systems have really changed, that's one thing. And storage, I think, so you've picked out some very good things. Now I want to look, turn to some, just review, there are many more than these. These are just things I thought of preparing this for today, but we're starting with the 1950s, post-war house, and looking to the present. These are things that I've seen that I think are significant culturally that have changed, and so. This has already been mentioned, average new construction of single-family home sizes increased from about 900 square foot, this is average new construction around 1950, to nearly 2,400 square feet by the early 21st century. It's a huge difference. And these are roughly the same socioeconomic group, although that's not exact. Increasing technological improvements, we've talked about that, sanitation, efficiency, electricity certainly, and everything that, we just moved from a 1950 house in Delaware to a 2005 house in Indiana, and one of the things that amazes me is the number of electrical sockets. It was always a struggle in that 1950 house to find one where you needed one, and they're all over the place in our new house, and that's certainly because of the number of things that you have to plug in. I believe that we've gone from conversation centers, where you have a room that's designed for a group of people to sit and converse over drinks, for instance, to media centers, rooms that are focused on a television, on a computer, on a Wii or a PlayStation now. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, it's just a definite difference in how we structure housing. So one thing to look at when you're looking at house plans is to think about where the focus of attention is, where people are being told to go to congregate. We're seeing workspaces re-entering the home. I was talking to Mary at dinner tonight who was saying she's working out of a home office now. That's increasingly the case. In the 18th century, there were a lot of home offices, also in the 19th century. When business was removed from the home, at least the mail business, towards the middle of the 20th century, that was less the case. But now we're seeing that increasingly again. So home offices. Specialized rooms, but different kinds of specialized rooms. A home gym. I saw that in a lot of houses recently. That's a new thing, to have a room that's devoted to a treadmill or a Stairmaster or something like that. A media center as well, or some, in a very expensive houses, kind of movie viewing rooms, which are seen now. A decrease generally in formal entertaining spaces. This is not true at the very high end, where you'll still have a formal dining room and a formal living room, but that is a holdover, I think, from a kind of entertaining that people don't do anymore. So there's some sense that it's nice to have a formal dining room. How many of you have a formal dining room that you use maybe, well, how many of you have a formal dining room that you use more than twice a week? How many of you have a formal dining room that you maybe use half a dozen times a year? So we're moving more away from that, but the reason for that is because we have these large spaces now, like the coming out of the bungalow, these really wonderful spaces that mean that you can cook and entertain at the same time. It's not the cook sequestered in the kitchen with the swinging door doing her thing and bringing the food out to the hot plate to entertain her guests. It's a very different kind of entertaining that we do now. More storage space, that's already been brought up, but closets, closets, closets. It's unbelievable when you're looking for a house and the people haven't moved out yet, but they're sort of half moved out, and you go in the basement and you see shelf upon shelf that's been built to store plastic boxes with things to get ready for the next move. Increasing bedrooms and bathrooms, I think bathrooms especially. We moved into a 2005 house. We have 3.5 bathrooms. Who needs 3.5 bathrooms in a house? It's really ridiculous. Our old house, 1950s house, one bathroom. And that's how many families raised their 4 children in smaller spaces with one bathroom. And then the increasing size of bathrooms. If there's one room in the house that's just grown in size, it's the bathroom with the spa tub and the double sink and lots of floor space.
Fireplaces
in the bathroom. Yes, truly amazing things. Yes. So what do you think that says, that bathrooms have become the center of
decadence?
All About Me.
Look in the mirror.
I'm guessing it has something to do with All About Me. Yeah, the kind of sense of spending time. It was kind of nice to take a leisurely bath and, I guess, by your fireplace. I'm not saying I wouldn't enjoy that, I'm just saying it certainly says something about our culture. 3-car garages are becoming very common. Some of that has to do with neighborhood restrictions that don't allow sheds or other storage spaces on the property, but sometimes there are definitely 3 cars that go along with these spaces. I think that's my last one. Okay, so those are trends. Now let's just look at those a little bit here. Here's a...
Yes. Those garages. I think a trend is to have a garage, but the car stays outside.
Yes, yes.
The seats are lined with the cars, and the garages are storage for the stuff.
Some more stuff. Bikes, boats, campers.
Yeah, I was actually photographing a new townhouse development I just completed, and saw exactly the opposite. There was the front of one townhouse unit where they had what was basically a faux garage door with a garden in front of it. So it was completely useless as a garage, and unfortunately I couldn't get in to see what was behind it. But I was sort of scratching my head over that. Our garage is becoming, in fact, completely vestigial space.
That is fascinating. Where was that?
That was in Langley, which is a suburb of Vancouver, BC.
Huh. Thank you. So. Here's Levittown, 1957. This is similar to the house we left in Delaware, where you have the one central bathroom, a few small bedrooms with increasingly large closets at this time, a kitchen with, these were very common at this time, the accordion door that separated the kitchen, but often those were just kept open, so you get a had a flow. And women who raise their children in these houses talk about how nice it was to be able to see out of that workspace and get a sense of what was going on with their children playing in the living room. But these are small houses. These are the 900 square foot houses. And if you go to Levittown now, virtually all of those houses have had major additions. That size of house just doesn't match the kind of lifestyle that most middle class Americans live now. Here are examples of these post-war houses, slightly larger houses, but modern style. And now I want to end with looking at two plans in detail. This is an adult living community in Scottsdale. by Toll Brothers, as I said, one of the major American developers today. This is a one-level house, two bedrooms, two baths, overall about average square footage for, and these are very nice buildings, very desirable neighborhoods, although I think Scottsdale's okay, but in general, Arizona has been pretty hard hit by the mortgage crisis. So what we're looking at here, can you all see this pretty well? Is that coming out clearly enough to be able to read the plan? Well, tell me what you see here that you think is culturally significant. If this is indicative of the kind of houses that many middle-class Americans aspire to now.
Living spaces where you sleep, where there's tables and chairs and bedrooms.
Two walk-in closets.
Two walk-in closets, very large closets.
Tons of sinks and baths.
Many sinks, and how many bathrooms are here?
Two.
Two, and there's an optional bath up here where the kitchen table is too. So, and presumably there's a couple living here, two people.
Well, that would give three eating areas.
Lots of eating areas, possibly.
Four if you count the patio.
Mm-hmm. This being Arizona, there's a much more sense of the inside, a free exchange between the inside and the outside, too. This wouldn't be the same if you were looking at North Dakota, I think.
Dimensions are pretty big.
They are. Big rooms. 28 by 24, that great room.
It's possible for people to absolutely hide from each other in a house like that.
That's true. I'm going to have to tell this anecdote because I find it fascinating. It relates to that point. I don't know if any of you ever saw these PBS specials. It was like reality TV for history buffs, and the one I'm thinking of is called Frontier House. Did anyone see that?
Yeah.
So they take these modern Americans and they send them to the wilds of Wyoming for 3 or 4 months, and they ask them to live as a pioneer family would have, and try to see if they can make it through the summer and actually grow enough grain and so forth for the winter, which they fail miserably at. And it's a wonderful show that reflects on patterns. But I was fascinated by this one family that was from Malibu, California, very wealthy family, and they had a couple of teenagers. They lived in, I think, a 6-bedroom house, and all the teenagers had their own rooms with their own televisions and media centers, and these two girls, especially about 16 and 17, just hated Frontier House for about 3 weeks. They had to get up at 5 o'clock and milk the cows, and it was too much family time, and they just couldn't stand it. But by the end, they had discovered that they were valuable to their families, and they were extremely lonely, and they felt very uncomfortable when they went back to Malibu. They felt that they were cut off from this, so it took some doing, but I thought that was very telling about the way that we think people want these private spaces, and you know, there are arguments for living far away from your teenagers. I see that's true, but then when you think about family and how space creates families or does damage to families, that's very interesting. So thanks for letting me tell that anecdote.
We had a large-ish home on Mercer Island. And we only lived a block from the high school, and so the other kids came over, and the kids are saying, well, how come your family, everyone's together, and our family, they're all off in their own room and everything. My daughter says, think about it. It's the only room that's heated.
there was that incentive.
We had a wood stove, and the rest of the house was 60, and the kitchen was 75.
Just the size of the master bath compared to the private one compared to one that's open for everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is truly a spa-like area, that master bath. I think it's just very large. This, I think, is what does that say? Optional what?
Optional, built-in.
Built-in. I think this is the media center, and it's interesting to me that the furniture is arranged. This chair is facing the media center, not facing back to the other couches for conversation.
That the fireplace, the media center, get equal floor space.
Yes.
Equal building.
Yeah.
I live in California. The newer construction the fireplace is there, and then the flat screen TV is above the fireplace as a built-in. And I find that fascinating, because it's like, you don't have to choose, you know, it's like, it used to be the hearth, and now it's the media center, now they're just putting them both on the same wall. But I don't know what that would be like to sit there with the fire going and the TV right above it. But it seems so strange to me.
To put those two things together.
Instead of having a mantelpiece with your family pictures or something.
I admit it was a convenient place to put it.
Yeah, but I've seen that one.
No, I've seen that many times too. I think the kitchen spaces are large entertaining spaces as well, so that you could see a casual dinner party here with people working together in the kitchen and maybe eating at the breakfast area or along a bar there. I think that's a bar on the outside wall, and that's fairly typical for these houses. Large, this is a feature that arose about 20 years ago and still hasn't gone away, these very large entry spaces that are not very useful space, except they kind of give you a sense of the family when you walk in. I don't want to offend any lawyers, but they're sometimes called lawyer foyers. And it's a wasteful use of space, but they have remained quite popular. Often tiled floors. Okay, I.
Frankly, right, and the foyer is very small, and they squeeze you into bigger spaces.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah.
You have to walk through the living room to get to the kitchen?
Well, unless you're coming in from the garage.
Oh, which you normally would be, really.
Yeah. But guests would be going through the living room into the kitchen.
Why a great room and a living room?
Well, what do you think? Why a great room and a living room?
So close.
I think that I don't know where the great room term originates. I mean, it goes back to the idea of the medieval hall. But I don't know when in modern parlance that became popular. But that's typical in builders' plans now, this idea of the great room. That's the gathering place for the family, where cooking, doing homework, casual entertaining, that all takes place. Would you say there are formal spaces in this plan here?
No.
Yes.
The dining room is kind of.
Oh, a dining room.
The great room.
It looks formal.
Great room. Would depend on what the sorts of things you put in that space, certainly. You could change the whole look of it by the decorative arts that were in there.
One thing about homes like this, they tend to have very little yard.
Yes.
If anything, they'll have a nice patio or something, but you really have shied away from space. It's all kind of enclosed inside rather than a space outside where you have grass or wood and living space outside.
Yes, and well, especially in these sorts of communities where you pay a fee to the neighborhood and they take care of mowing your lawn and that sort of thing, and spaces tend to be smaller. Sometimes these communities have very nice communal areas, which is something I'm not showing you, but centralized parks, like the new urbanists believe very much in smaller lot sizes, but good community spaces, because, for instance, in my neighborhood, where the lots are about a half an acre, I'd say every other house has a playset in the backyard. And you think, that's kind of crazy when you could have a central park and the kids could play together. And that's about the privatization of space and the atomization of families. And so architects and planners are trying to figure out how to solve problems like that and create a better sense of community.
You mentioned before the change from conversation spaces to media spaces.
To being entertained.
And being entertained. I find it as a very modern thing. There's a movement back to making conversation spaces. Foster Borgman, probably 15, 20 years ago, was writing a lot about technology taking away that conversation that happened in the home around the hearth and around doing chores around the house. Everything's automated now, so we don't have to chop wood. And so this is kind of a technological way with the gourmet kitchen even of recapturing that conversation space, because it still struggles with media, you know, going to your private space to plug in or whatever. But this seems to me to try to recapture that. even though it's, I'm sure, very high-tech.
We've done a few things. We were able to customize a house design, and one thing, we've had a number of great rooms, two or three planned with great rooms, and the one that I least liked was the biggest and rectangular. Because when you're cooking, you have to like walk over to the edge of the family room to have the conversation instead of, so our house now is smaller than every other one in the neighborhood, but you can talk from the island to the family room person sitting in the neighborhood. So there's conversation spaces, but it's not normal. And the other thing we did was put the office right off the family room. I was telling you at dinner, I have a love-hate relationship with it because the kids are all plugged in there and we can see it and it's right there. But it's right there. But it's, you know, it's, there's pros and cons. But we didn't wire the bedrooms, and everybody told us we were crazy. So there's no televisions and things in the kids' bedrooms. So whether we'll be able to sell the house or not, that is wireless. But it was, you guys are crazy not putting TVs and computers in the bedrooms. We put them downstairs where we all are. So we'll see. So far, it works very well for us, but it'll be interesting. And the builders were like, we've never seen it. But we also have a living room. We have a formal living room, and that's the only room with the fireplace. So that it's a draw to that, and it functions like a library. It's built with shelving, like a bungalow. Mm-hmm. And so we have different purposes for it, but we are also one of two or three in the neighborhood of 20 houses that has a living room. But I like to have a place to go read while everybody's talking.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how people live.
I was just kind of wondering, because I was listening to you, I spent my childhood in a home where my parents lived for 4 decades, and it was a home where, as I look back on it, my parents made sure that it was functional, but I think we were satisfied with the home when they left it. As they reviewed into their life as they did when we were kids. My wife and I have lived in the same house for 34 years, and we're very satisfied with it. And it just seems to me that the growth in the size of the rooms in the houses not only is driven so much by our stuff, but by other people's expectations of our house that my parents didn't have, and I don't think my wife and I had. Or the idea that you're not going to be there very long anymore, and you have to buy a house that somebody else is going to find attractive. And in fact, you, as we found out last year, people have decided that it's a source of retirement income for themselves by selling up all the time. And that was a part of the mentality when I was a kid. And I think that's what drives some of this. A lot of it, I think.
Yes, and builders say that the housing market works against unique buildings because you really are buying something that you know will sell again. And there's also, how people actually live in spaces is different from what builders and developers anticipate. We all adapt our spaces in ways that meet our own choices and lifestyles. I think I wish I had the statistics for mobility, but it definitely relates to that as well. Generation of people who, as you say, don't expect to live in that place for 30 or 40 years.
I mean, I'm just not sure that people are really buying and building houses for themselves anymore so much.
And also, when you go to a new development, maybe some of you do this for a hobby or just like to go check out what builders are doing, what decorators are doing, everything is carefully staged now. In fact, you can hire someone to stage your own home when you're trying to sell it, and you're not selling the building as much as kind of dream of a certain lifestyle that would exist in that building. So that's, I have.
Have you looked at Cole housing?
Co-housing. Yeah, that's becoming much more popular now, especially with changes in the housing market. I think we're out of time, but this was the other. This is the 4,600 square foot house.
Oh, wow.
In that same, no, there's one on the left side, so there are two garages, this is, you know, on the real high end of things, but typical of that high end, and you'll see many of the same features you saw in the 2,300 square foot house, just more so, and more expensive finishes and so forth.
Look at that dining
room. Yeah, and here in these high end houses, you still see formal dining rooms and formal living rooms because that's part of estate living, country living. It goes along with what it means to be landed gentry, basically, to have these formal entertaining spaces, whether or not you use them. No, we don't, but they're still in those houses.
Does that say bonus room?
Yes, that's what they call it. It's usually a room over a garage.
Playroom or
something that it makes it sound like you've won the lottery.
Oh, I got the bonus room. It doesn't have a closet, is why it's a bonus room, not another bedroom. Yeah. So that one might have a cabinet.
Or maybe farther away from the bathrooms or other uses. Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.